Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Know-How is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want, when you want, with access to over 2,000 high-quality online courses and training videos, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/know-how. That's LYNDA.com/know-how. Today, you'll know how to tap your network using Wireshark, how you can sweeten up your home theater audio, and a whole lot more. Welcome back to Know How. I'm Ayaz Akhtar, along with...
I'm Father Robert Ballaser.
And this is that show where we give you a couple of how-to fun projects that you can do yourself. Let's see, right up front, I noticed, Padre, we seem to have...
A lot of computers.
A lot of computers for some reason. Yeah. Are you going... Is this a garage sale? What's going on?
I hope not, because I like these devices. I thought maybe we might want to show our audience a bit about tapping, specifically using a program called Wireshark, which is free, to take a look at their home networks, find out what's going on, and maybe diagnose a couple of problems.
Okay, so what's the first thing we should know about tapping a network? Do I need hardware, software, combo? What do I need?
Well, the first thing is to get a tapping device. That's step one. Last week, you'll remember, we did a quick tip about what taps are and how they work, and we showed you a few taps that you could use. These right here, these are my favorite. So these are taps by NetOptics. That's called a 10-100 aggregating tap, so that gives me traffic in both directions. This one's called a gigabit non-aggregating tap.
Okay.
These are what I use in my professional work whenever I need to find out what's going on a network.
So professional, they must be dirt cheap.
Right? Well, okay, so, yeah, I mean, relatively, they only run between a few hundred and... $1,000.
So we have stuff more affordable for
them? Yeah, we do, yeah. Right. So yeah, if you can get these, I mean, if you could find them on eBay, someone doesn't know what they are, absolutely grab one. But we thought, hey, you know what? The folks at home deserve to be able to get a device that's not going to break the bank. That's why we've got this thing. If you look at the product cam, this is a little throwing star land tap from Great Scott Gadgets. We picked this one up from the Hack Store. Now, it's a 10-100 tap, and the idea is you've got the purple cables. That's just like the device, the two devices you're connecting.
Because this is connected to this laptop over here,
right.
And this is connected to...
The switch.
The switch itself. Okay.
Right. So imagine, like, this wire's going off to the router. This one's going off to the laptop. This orange cable is actually siphoning off the packets. It's looking at the packets going from the laptop to the switch. Now, if I were to flop this around on the other side, I could look at the packets going from... the other direction.
Okay.
Right. So this allows me to peek in on what's going on the wire without actually changing the traffic.
What did this cost again compared to your professional tap here?
Okay, so $1,000 over here, right. Like $40 here.
$40?
Yeah, $40.
Okay, so now we can mess with people.
Now we can mess with people.
For fun.
For fun, and not for a whole lot. Now, that's the first step. So the first step is to find yourself a tapping device. Find yourself something that runs in your price range that can pull traffic off the network. Step two is to get a device that is capable of receiving the packet stream. For most people, that's like an old laptop.
Okay.
I have a nice one here, but any laptop that has a gigabit interface is going to do just fine.
So this orange cable that we have in this throwing star here, it's connected to your laptop, but you have a USB adapter. Is that all this is?
Right.
There's nothing specific or special about this adapter.
Nothing special.
It's because this Ultrabook doesn't have an Ethernet port.
Correct. Now, here's a note. If you've got one of the older Ultrabooks that only has USB 2.0, be careful because USB 2.0 tops out at 480 megabits per second. It's half, less than half of what gigabit Ethernet can do. So
does that mean you're just going to get you're not going to get all the data, or are you talking about just getting low quantities of data?
You'll get all the data up to the point at which it hits that limit, and then packets will just disappear.
Okay, so you can't, what's a good tap? What's the use of tapping if you can't see everything?
Right, exactly. If you drop out the one packet you were looking for, it's kind of, yeah. So find yourself a cheap laptop.
It's like a half tap, anyway.
Yeah, half tap, I like. Show title. No, find yourself a cheap laptop that has a wired connection. That's really what you want.
Okay.
I mean, you can find those for $100, $200. Get an old netbook. As long as it's got that port, you're good to go. So that's your device to tap. That's your device to receive the tap. Step three is to get Wireshark. Now, Wireshark can be found at www.wireshark.org. There's versions for Mac, for Linux, for PC, 32, 64-bit. So you've got to find the version that's right for whatever operating system you're using. It's free. You just click the version you want, download, and install. That's your step three.
So Wireshark, this is available for free?
Right, yeah. That's a perfect price.
All right, that's a good tool to mess with. So Wireshark, it doesn't matter what you're running. You've got a Mac, PC, Linux, like you said.
Work
piece of cake.
Anything. Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
Now what do we do with Wireshark?
Now, step four. Yeah, this is where it starts to get a little complicated. You got to choose where you're going to put your tap. And this is actually really important. This is probably the most important thing you're going to do because everything else follows from this. We've got this wonderful board that was drawn by our very own Greg Burnett. And it shows you what a typical home network might look like. You've got your cable, your DSL router.
Your modem.
You've got your router. Most people have the wireless integrated into the router, but I put it separate. Then you've got a couple devices that are connected to your network wirelessly, and a few computers that are connected via a wired connection. Anywhere along these lines, these wired lines, is where I can put the tap. Now, the tap will give me the traffic between two devices, which means if I put the tap here, it will give me all the traffic going between the modem and the router, which is essentially all the traffic running out to the internet or in from the internet to the network,
mm-hmm.
right? If I put it here, up on the AP line, it's only going to give me the traffic that goes between the router and any wirelessly connected device.
So if you want to be most inclusive, you're between the router and the modem.
Right.
And if you want to be on the wireless network, you go between the access point and the router there.
Correct. And then let's say I want to troubleshoot a specific PC. Let's say I've got a PC that I think is acting weird. I'm thinking, I think this is maybe part of a botnet.
Okay.
Go ahead and put the tap just on that wire, and now you're only getting the traffic between the router and the PC. What it helps to do is to actually draw this out, draw what your network looks like so that you can say, yeah, I want to put the tap right here so I can find out who's using up my internet connection.
Yeah, if you don't have a snazzy artist like we have Greg Burnett every now and then come by. You can always use a cocktail napkin or something like that at the back of your hand. It'll work just the same as long as you map it out. This is actually pretty simple here.
This is simple, and actually I thought it was going to be a lot prettier because, you know, Greg's supposed
don't
to be
don't trash
an
the
artist.
Art. The art's beautiful.
Anyway. Okay. Well,
I like it.
So now you've found out where you're going to put your tap, right? So, like for you, let's say you want to find out what's going on with this PC.
Yes, that PC computer number one, there's been a real problem for
it's
me.
It's been a real
it's
problem.
Been slow it's slow, and yeah, I don't know what's going on with it. I want to know what's going on there.
Okay, so we're going to put the tap right there.
Okay.
Which means the next step is to start your capture. Now, this is what the interface for Wireshark looks like. If you switch over to my PC screen, it's it kind of undecipherable right now. In fact, I'm going to do something that's going to make it even more undecipherable.
Okay, I'm liking where this is going.
Yeah. So I'm going to start my capture, and this is actually running in between PC1. So this is your PC1 that you said you wanted to find out what was going on.
PC1's one I'm messing with right now.
Right, and over to the router, and then right here I've got my one tap. I'm only looking at the traffic going from the PC out to the router, not the other way. And I'm going to start, if you go back to my interface, I'm going to start my capture. And now this is only the packets that are going from that PC out to the internet. So right now, don't show me, but go ahead and type in a website. Go to a website, any website. Pick a site.
Any website. I'm going to pick a site that nobody would ever go to. There's no way on earth this is on your machine.
And you're starting to see the packets flow. So this is the packets that are flowing from his computer out to the router. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put DNS. So I'm in the filter box here, which means I'm only wanting to look at packets that have a DNS call in them. And I see here that the very first, I see a Bing call, I see a MySpace call, I see a Google call, I see another MySpace call. So it looks like you're going either to MySpace or Facebook. Oh, here's the weird thing. Notice, what site did you go to?
I went to MySpace.com.
You went to MySpace. Notice all those other sites that are popping up. Those are all the other calls that site is going to make. It calls over to MySpace, but also to Facebook, also to Vinit, Kodo Suite, whatever, a couple to Google, a couple to Akamai. That shows you all the different places that your computer's actually accessing when you access a simple website. So it's not just going to MySpace.
Well, yeah, taking a look at this is probably because you can sign in to MySpace with Facebook because they've pretty much given up entirely.
Right.
But that's a whole other thing. But you're seeing where those are all coming from. And from what you saw there, you can determine what site I'm visiting. Is there any way that you could like have a best guess? Can you match it to something else? Do you keep a catalog to be like, I know that's MySpace. I know that's Facebook.
Some people try to do that. You can make custom filters. And I'm actually going to show you how to play with the filters in a bit. But, yeah, some people who are really into this, they'll make a database and they'll start associating certain URLs with certain companies. But trying to do that in a stream capture, it's actually really tough because you've gone to one site. Now, imagine if I was tapping an entire network with 40 computers. It's going to get a little difficult.
I'll
be there forever. So what we want to do is, after we started capturing, so if you go back to my interface, in this very small amount of time, all of these packets have been captured just from that one laptop. I mean, imagine that. All of this from one connection, one side of one connection going out to the internet has been captured by Wireshark. That's cool, but if you're the know-it-all sitting at home, you're thinking, I have no idea what that means. So I'm going to show you how to use this data to find some real-world problems. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to stop this capture. And I'm going to bring up some captures I did just the other night. This first one is to figure out, let's say you want to find out if your computer has been owned and it's being used in a botnet. So this is real world traffic that I captured off of the network last night. What I did was I put the tap between a PC and the internet. And this is just a few seconds of capture. What I'm going to do is up in the filter, I'm going to put SMTP, which is the Simple Mail Transport Protocol. Mm-hmm. Since this computer was not doing anything, it should not have
any...
Shouldn't
have shown that at all.
Because SMTP is only mail.
Yeah, unless you have like Outlook running in the background, which you didn't on this machine.
Correct.
It's just something... That's
so
not,
I filter
okay.
it, and whoa, wait a minute.
Why
I'm getting
all
these packets that were calling out to SMTP. That right there, I don't have to go any further. I know. There's something wrong with this computer. It was making SMTP calls when I wasn't using the computer. This is like the simplest thing to do with Wireshark and with a tap, which is if you suspect that your computer might be participating in a botnet, run this. If it's got any SMTP packets when you're not running email, there is something wrong.
Okay, so that's the way you can find out if it's making those calls. What other searches could you do to check anything else that's going on with your machine?
Yeah, there's a couple that I think people should know about. The second one is going to be to look for... what did I have? Oh, for top talkers. This one I love. So let's say you have a network at home and it's always slow, but nobody owns up to using up all the bandwidth. You know there's someone who's doing Netflix.
So like, this is actually really good in an apartment. When you have like this, you got four or five roommates and you're like, I got to do this Skype call. I'm going to Skype in with somebody. I need all the bandwidth. If any of you are BitTorrenting, I need to know that because we need to have this thing. This is one way to do this.
This is one way to do this. So what we have here is I actually captured the stream from an office close by.
Okay, and an office nearby.
Nearby, okay. And this is about 100 megabyte file. So it's 100 megabytes of capture. So there is a lot of packets in here. But Wireshark actually gives me a really easy way to find out who was what I call the top talker. If you go to statistics,
okay.
Conversations, it will actually start priming on all of this. And I've actually done this ahead of time, so this is what it looks like this. So this shows me all the different clients that were connected to that network. And if I click IPv4, which is the standard that, we typically use, and I click on bytes, it's now going to sort by who's using up the most data. So obviously, I see that very first one, 68 megabytes versus 15 megabytes for the next top talker. So I know right there, okay, that person is using way more bandwidth than everybody else, and I can find out who it is just by looking at address A. That tells me, okay, this computer is sucking up all the bandwidth. I got to go have a talk with Mr. Netflix or Mr. YouTube and say, cut it out because you're killing the network.
Yeah,
for
so you can
else.
Go into your router, check out your client table, and then find out who's got 194 at the end of the day.
Right, because they normally have a name next to it, like Sarah iPad. Oh, Sarah, stop playing Ways to Die or whatever it is that's sucking up.
I'm sure it wasn't Sarah. That seems
Sarah.
Like that could be any one of us at that nearby building. I have no idea what we're talking about.
Right, right. Of course.
So you get your top talkers that way. That's pretty neat.
That's my top talkers. Okay. The other one I really like, and as we're going to get a little gray hat here.
Okay, I'm not really a hat-wearing guy, but all right.
Remember, last week I was talking about how sometimes I would run a honeypot and I would start searching.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Uh-huh, I remember that.
Because people are not supposed to send their username or password in the clear. So in other words, it's always supposed to be encrypted, but of course, people still do it. It's amazing how many times people still do it. Here's a string that you can use to find a password inside this capture. So I've got a capture here. This is not that long. This was just, I think, for 30 seconds here in the brick house. I actually don't know if there's a password in here, but what I'm going to do, in the filter, I'm going to put password. Oh, sorry. TCP contains password. So what I'm saying is look through the TCP string and look. Tell me any packet that contains the word password. And so I'm going to hit enter. And there's one. So I've got one packet in here that has a password in the clear. And if I double click that, I can now bring up this, which shows you what's actually contained inside of that packet. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look really quick through the string. I'm going to look for password, which is, oh, there it is. Okay, so password is right about there. And it tells me the username was, Cranky Hippo. Okay, so username was Cranky Hippo and password was Padre Man Crush. Okay, I'm not sure what that's all about. But there you see, and now that's a very quick demo of what you could do. So if you were running this on your network, back here between the cable, DSL modem, and the router, if anybody on your network sends a password in the clear, you can capture it.
And that's why you should always use LastPass, people.
Unless
LastPass came up with Padre Man Crush, which is actually it's the one that's the number one that shows up.
Yeah, go figure.
It's one of the most normal ones.
But no, encrypt. Okay, so this last bit, the last bit before I send them off on their merry way to play with Wireshark, is a bit more complicated. It's called TCP retransmission. Whenever your network gets too slow, it's really easy to blame, it's the wireless, or it's Comcast, it's the guy next door who turned on his microwave and blotted out 2.4, whatever it might be. You know, everyone has their favorite reason why the network is slow. With Wireshark, I can actually find out. I can actually look for the cause. And the way that I'm going to do that is, again, I've got a stream here, and I'm going to type in tcp.analysis.retransmissions. And what it's looking for is it's going to filter through all of this. It's going to look for packets that have had to be retransmitted. So in other words, there was errors.
So that's why it's slowing down, because you're trying to send something out, it's not going out.
Exactly. So if you send a packet and it gets blocked somewhere, it gets stepped on, there's a bad switch, there's a bad connection, it's going to retransmit. And now this happens regularly in a network, but what I'm looking for is I'm looking for an overabundance of retransmissions. I'm looking for a huge block of retransmissions. And then I can look at the source and the destination address and say, the problem exists between that device and that device. And now I can actually go back to my network and say, what's going on here? Is this a bad wire? Is this a bad connection, a bad jack, a bad switch, a bad piece of hardware? And look, wow. Oh, I did not expect that many. in this dark black, these are all TCP retransmissions.
So lots of errors here.
Yeah, lots of errors. So this is all the traffic that had to be sent at least twice. Now, multiply that by as many devices as you may have on the network, and that can tell you why you're going so slow. And what I can do over here is I look over for the source and the destination, and if I group it by the source, I can actually look if there's a device or a couple of devices that make up the majority of those packets.
Yeah. So once you have that information, what could you do with that? Could you take that machine, just take it off the network and try to figure out what's going on with it? Or are you talking about there's a bigger issue with your network? What can you do with that information once you have it?
Right. So once you have that information, I can save all these files. So I don't have to be sitting there in front of my modem. I can take it back to my room, back to my office, and I can actually start scanning through the packets at my own perusal. Typically, you're not looking for one single problem. You record everything, and then when you do have a problem, it gives you sort of a forensic tool to go back and see what happened. It's a very cool way to use an incredibly free tool with a not that expensive device. In fact, in the future, I think on KnowHow, we're going to do a project where I'm going to show you how to make one of these taps for nothing
For nothing.
For next to nothing.
For nothing. Right. I'm just going to steal the, we're going to steal the parts?
We're going to, well, yeah.
Steal the parts? Yeah. Yes.
We're going to
steal the parts.
We're in there.
Zero cost. I'm liking this idea.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, it might cost more than a
so please, you know, if you get a chance, this is a great tool to play with. I've in the show notes, I've included a couple of strings that you can try, a couple of filters that are easy to play
with. You can just make up those strings off the top of your head?
Yeah, those are just off the top of my head. Just,
but they'll be available at twit.tv/KH.
twit.tv/KH. And there you can learn all about Wireshark. But you know what? I think maybe now we need to find another place where we could learn stuff.
Yeah, we should definitely take a break and thank our sponsor, Lynda.com. Now, Lynda.com is an online learning company that helps anyone learn creative software or business skills. And business skills, depends if you want to have both. And the thing is, with the Lynda.com subscription, members receive unlimited access to a vast library of high-quality, current, and engaging video tutorials around the web, on a bunch of different subjects you can get on this Lynda.com. I was in my garage the other day. I was cleaning out a bunch of different pieces of software. I'm like, I don't need this Instant 3D from Windows 3.1. But I did find, apparently I bought Logic Pro 8. So I went to Lynda.com, and I wanted to check if they had courses, and sure enough, they do. I was looking at the Logic Pro 8 Essential Training videos, and they are fantastic. They're explaining to me how to use this software. Logic Pro, if you don't know, is an audio editor. It's kind of like GarageBand, but it's more for professionals. Yeah, this is the actual one I was messing with, Logic Pro 8. And you can see that everything is organized. You've got your introduction, welcome, and you can jump around. So if you're familiar with something, you can jump around in these lists. It's really fantastic that way. And if you, let's say you're not going through your garage and you don't even know where to start, Lynda.com has curated playlists that highlight the most relevant courses you'll need to learn a particular topic, subject, or skill. You can learn things like WordPress or design, create a website, how to find a job, how to negotiate raises, all kinds of cool things like that. Create animations, videos with DSLRs if you wanted to do that. They've got tutorials there. And once you shot those videos, how are you going to edit? Well, Lynda.com's got that stuff covered as well. I also was taking another Lynda.com course because, like I mentioned, this is unlimited. You get access to everything. I'm taking a course that teaches me Premiere because I'm a Final Cut guy. I need to learn how to transition. So I'm taking lots of courses at once because you can do that. You've got unlimited access to over 2,000 courses. This week, they've added new courses, including Analytics, Creative Quick Tips, Adobe InDesign, and Logic X Pro Essentials. That's the newer version of Logic, which I don't have just yet. The instructors are working professionals at the top of their fields and expert teachers. You got high-quality video production from state-of-the-art studios. This isn't like some homemade YouTube video where you can't hear anything or you can't see anything. This stuff is high-quality. Curated course content. Each Lynda course is carefully structured so that users can learn from start to finish or jump to a specific chapter for quick answers. They also have searchable transcripts because, you know, video is sometimes trouble. So they have searchable transcripts that allow you to search inside a video, saves you time, and find exactly what you're looking for. You can also bookmark, and you can have these playlists so you can figure out what you want to do. Courses for all kinds of levels for these courses. So if you're talking about technical skills, creative techniques, business strategies, all that stuff's at Lynda.com. And one of my favorite things, you can watch from your computer, tablet, or mobile device, and you can switch back and forth between the devices you're using. So if you start off on your iPad, and then you want to go to your desktop, and then you want to go to another device, it's going to keep picking up where you left off. So it's really fantastic with that playlist. You get to set the pace with mobile access. You learn what you want, when you want. It's only $25 a month for access to Lynda's entire course library. Or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's project using the exact same materials they're using. And you can try out Lynda.com right now with a free 7-day trial. Visit lynda.com/knowhow to access the entire library. That's over 2,000 courses free for 7 days. That's lynda.com/knowhow. And we thank lynda.com for their support of knowhow. There's some great material there.
You know what I like about Lynda? I actually was playing on the site the other day, and I've been doing Premiere. I mean, I'm a Premiere guy. I've been doing it for 10 years. But I started looking at their tutorials, and I realized that even though I've been using it so long, there were some things that I should have known from the very beginning, and I never did.
Sometimes you just get used to that workflow, and you're like, I kind of know that. But then sometimes you're like, whoa, these are trained instructors. So they've really shown you things that you might not have seen.
It's good stuff.
It's fantastic. It's just, I just love switching from my devices. I have enough devices at this point. Nexus 7, now to my iPad, now to my laptop. Or I'll steal one of your laptops because I can see it on the web. Anyway, so for my project, for this part of the show, I am going to present to you part two of audio calibration with Scott Wilkinson. Now, we got Scott in from Home Theater Geeks to talk about how to set up your home theater audio. And what we went through in part one, we'll have a link to part one at twit.tv/KH. I'll actually have it in the show notes of part one. We figured out how to design your room and how to place your speakers and how to actually have audio calibration with that little microphone that comes with a lot of AVRs. But there is one problem when it comes to those little things. Let's go to our know-it-all.
Now, the problem is that these automatic calibration systems don't always do a great job. They might misidentify how far the speaker is, or they might call it might say, oh, this can reproduce all the ranges of frequencies from 20 to 20,000 hertz, which is the entire human hearing range, mm-hmm. when in fact it can't. But the automatic system is only so good. It can't be perfect. So if you're a perfectionist, you want to do it manually. And the way you want to do it manually is you want to get a sound level meter. Here is the Radio Shack sound meter. It's $40-$50. You can get it also in a digital version that has a digital readout here instead of a needle that moves. And this tells us, this lets us measure sound levels in a room. So, for example, in this room right now, I'm reading about, with me talking, about 72 decibels.
All right.
And this is meters close to me.
Right to you.
If it were farther away, if you move it farther away, and you take a look at the reading, it should be around zero for 70.
So down here, so this is the 70, you already set the range to 70?
Right, correct.
The top?
I set the range to 70, so zero is 70.
Gotcha.
And you can tell if I stand farther away, now I'm out of camera, it's probably under 70.
Yeah, around that, a little like 68.
Yeah, exactly. So what you do is you take one of these, I set it to 70, and I tell the receiver to play the test tone in the right front speaker. And I put this on a tripod. There's a nice little tripod mount.
Keep it in that one space, the one
keep
spot.
Keep it in the one spot, and I tell it to play the test tone, and then I adjust the level from the receiver of that channel until it reads 75. And then I move the test tone to the center, and then to the left front.
And so you want them all matched to 75? Because that's the way you're doing
matched. It. Exactly right. And they're going to be different distances away, which means their levels aren't going to be precisely the same. Now, before you do that, you do have to go into the menu of the receiver and tell it how far each speaker is from your seat. So you have to get out your tape measure. This is a little more involved, which is why some people like the automatic approach. But you take your tape measure, and you go from your seat to here, and you go from your seat to here, and you enter that data into the receiver with the remote. Very important to have the receiver's on-screen display displaying on your TV. And you might think, okay, well, that's easy. Video's coming from the receiver to the TV anyway. Here's the weird part. Many receivers do not send their on-screen display, their menu, to the TV over HDMI.
Really? So what, they use like a component?
They use a composite. They use the little yellow RCA jack, which is the worst.
Like the thing that you effectively at this point you've kind of thrown out as a concept.
Right.
Why would
right.
you be using analog video, really? Some of these guys are sending out their on-screen displays, which you want to see because you want to put in this information.
Correct.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Correct. So, and many cases these days you will see it over HDMI, but in some cases, particularly older receivers, you won't. So you need to have that extra connection to your TV, which is kind of weird. But you really want to see that on-screen display in order to input this information. Then you have to tell the receiver, if you're doing this manually, are these speakers large or small? Now, by that I mean, if it's large, it can reproduce the entire frequency range from 20 to 20.
So this isn't about the size of the speaker.
It's sort of. It's sort of related to the size of the speaker. Because a small speaker will never get down to low frequencies.
All right.
Large speakers can, don't always. But, so you tell them whether or not they're large or small. Any of the small speakers, the information, the sonic information in that channel, the low frequencies get redirected to the subwoofer. So if you have a bunch of small speakers that can't go down to 50, 60 hertz or lower, you want to but there's information in that frequency range, mm-hmm. in the signal, in the content. So you want that information to be rerouted to the receiver and to the subwoofer, sorry. And so every time you tell that a speaker is small, that low frequency information for that channel gets redirected to the subwoofer. My general recommendation is to tell your receiver that all your speakers are small, even if they're not. Because I'd rather have all of the low frequency information coming out of the subwoofer, having the subwoofer do the heavy lifting, if you will, for a number of reasons. First of all, that's what it's designed to do. Mm-hmm. Second of all, the place where you put the subwoofer for optimum performance is often different than the best place to put the main speakers, the front, right, and left, and surround speakers. If you have bass audio coming out of these main speakers, you may get more of this standing wave problem, which you won't or less of it, if you put the subwoofer in the right place.
Okay, so the data that's supposed to be, I guess, destined for the left speaker, the left front speaker, it's not, when you send it to the non-directional subwoofer, isn't that going to change the way you're supposed to hear it? Like, are you really going to hear the true sound of what the director intended? Well, or is that a speaker issue?
Once again, you said the magic word, non-directional. Low frequencies are non-directional. You can't tell where they're coming from, so it doesn't matter.
Aha, okay.
Exactly.
So you don't have to feel bad about your inadequately small speakers.
No.
As long as you have an adequate subwoofer.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And you have the subwoofer adequately located. You have it placed in the room. Now, there's a really cool technique called the subwoofer crawl, which is this.
So that's when you go to a bunch of different subwoofers and have a drink, and then you can't.
Right, exactly.
Okay, wait a minute.
No. You put the subwoofer in your seat.
Okay.
Okay. And you play a piece of music or a soundtrack or something that you know very well. Okay. While that soundtrack is playing and the subwoofer is sitting in your seat, you crawl around the periphery of the room,
all right,
listening to the sound. And wherever you can find that the sound sounds the smoothest without a lot of bumps in, that frequency is very high and that frequency is very low, but it sounds very smooth and natural, that's where you place your subwoofer. Then you take the subwoofer out of your seat and you put it there.
Okay, that's what I have to do.
That's called the subwoofer crawl.
I'm thinking right now, I'm like, my subwoofer's in a corner. Doesn't belong there now. I have to find a spot. I can't really move my couch, but this is the kind of thing I have to figure out when
you
I'm doing a little crawl.
Put your subwoofer in that couch. And then you play some music that you're familiar with. That's important.
Something I kind of know sonically.
It has a lot of bass in it, too. You know, so, I don't know, whatever you listen to that's got a lot of kind of bass in it. And you crawl around the periphery of your room. And where do you hear the best,
smoothest sound?
Smoothest
where
sound.
Your subwoofer goes.
Exactly.
This sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, and then it'll have some, you'll be hearing what the directors have intended and the sound designers have designed.
Correct.
Wow.
That's exactly right.
And this is the stuff you can do yourself, right?
Yeah.
You're crawling around.
Yeah, you can crawl around. You can do this manual setup, which is you measure the distance. Oh, and one other thing to make sure of is the wires that connect your receiver to your speakers.
Mm-hmm.
There are two conductors. There's a red one and a black one. Mm-hmm. You want to make really sure that the red output on the receiver is connected to the red input on the speaker. And the black to black. If you reverse those, it's called phase inversion, and it causes the sound to become muddled and indistinct.
As a Beatles fan, I know about that oops thing where you can kind of switch the way the cables go and you hear a different, totally different sound.
Right.
But the thing is, that's with the intention of trying to have a different sound. Just pay attention to the red and the black.
Right. On the back. Exactly. Exactly right. So you've got your phase correct, you've got your distances measured, you've said to the speaker, to the receiver, that your speakers are all small, typically, which sends everything to the subwoofer. The last step is, what is the frequency below which things start get shunting off to the subwoofer, right? We talked about how if you designate your speakers as small, then the low frequencies get redirected to the subwoofer, okay? At what frequency does that happen? THX says 80 hertz, 80 cycles per second. But what you really need to do is take a look at the specs of your speakers and say, for example, your surrounds only go down to 100.
Okay.
Okay, and they're not specified to go any lower than that. I would set your crossover, it's called the crossover, is the frequency at which the bass frequencies start getting redirected. I would set it at least 100. And I would do that for all the speakers because you want the sound field, you want the sound coming from each of these speakers to be as consistent as possible, right? So if you set a different crossover for each of these speakers, then this one's going to be sending you somewhat lower frequencies than this one, for example. And that's going to, you might not be able to identify it as, oh, well, that one's sending me lower frequencies than that one. But you're going to say, something feels weird. Something feels odd. You want things to be as consistent as possible, which is why I recommend, if you're going to buy a 5.1 speaker system, you get it from the same manufacturer. You don't get JBLs here and Teal here and Boston Acoustics here, right? Because they all voice their speakers differently. Mm-hmm. And so you want a consistent sound field throughout. I always recommend getting from the same manufacturer and, whenever possible, from the same line within that manufacturer. Manufacturers have, you know, their premium lines and their middle-of-the-road lines and their budget lines. Wherever you can afford, get all your speakers from the same line. And that will go a long way towards making the entire sound field very consistent and seamless around you, which is really what you want. You don't want the sound of a helicopter going from here to here to all of a sudden have a big tonal change when it passes through the middle speaker. Right, because that takes you right out of the movie.
That's with the five speakers. With the subwoofer, you don't worry about that as much?
You don't have to worry about that as much. You can get a subwoofer from a different manufacturer because they are reproducing very specifically the low frequencies, and there's not as much concern there.
You know what's funny? When we asked Scott to talk to us about audio calibration, he was like, I don't have a whole lot to talk about. And he had so much phenomenal information. We've broken it up into two parts. We'll have everything we talked about in that interview available at twit.tv/KH, as well as links to the first part. But that was some amazing stuff from Scott, explaining to us what we could do to get our home theater to sound awesome.
I love the advice about the crawl. I mean, it makes sense. If you think about it, yeah, if you put the speaker where you're going to be, then you can find out where the speaker should be when you're actually sitting
there. It makes sense if you're high or something. I got this idea.
Yeah, who came up with that?
I will replace me with the subwoofer, but it works. And the thing is, I have to do this crawl as well. It just seems crazy.
And as Sandstrom in the chat room has said, if you're going to do this right, you have to do it naked so that your clothes don't soak up any of the sound.
Right. That's exactly how it is. Yeah. Scott was too shy to mention the whole nudity aspect. But we did grab Scott for an extra little bit of his time because we wanted to ask him some questions and just knock out some confusion about home theaters and, well, just in general, geekery. While we have Scott Wilkinson here, we're going to ask him a couple of questions that have been eating my mind up, a lot of the other twits' minds as well. Since you're the expert in all things home theater, I want to ask you this question. Question number one, ever a reason to leave the motion smoothing of your television on?
I say the answer is yes. When you're watching anything that was shot on video to begin with, like sports, newscasts possibly, because video smoothing, or what is called frame interpolation, on an LCD TV primarily, inserts new frames in between the existing ones to smooth out the motion. Works great. But when you apply it to movies, which were shot at 24 frames per second, it makes them look like they were shot on video. It makes them look like they were shot on a soap opera stage, which is why it's called the soap opera effect. So when you're watching a movie at 24 frames per second, turn it off. But when you're watching video, particularly football or something that has fast motion in it, I like it because it already looks like video because it was shot on video. And it smooths out that motion of the football moving around or the tennis ball or whatever, giving you a sharper image. Some people would disagree. This is a point of great contention.
This is shocking to hear, because I would think, I always want to see NFL film style stuff. Now it would look like NFL video.
Well, I mean, if they're, I don't think NFL is shooting on film.
Oh, no, not, but the NFL films division, there's a whole other thing.
We're
like, on the field of Lambeau Field, that whole thing.
Okay, well, if they're shooting at 24 frames per second.
Keep it on 24.
Turn it off. Turn it off. But if they're shooting in video, turn it off.
Question number two from Patrick Delahanty. In the field of audio, can you replace your speaker wire with coat hanger? And would you even notice?
This is a great question. I wouldn't, because the coat hanger is not insulated.
So just wrap it with some tape and that'd be okay?
Then it would sort of be okay. It's also not very flexible. So you can't route it around corners. If you unwrap a coat hanger, it's not that long.
So you're finding the impracticalities. But sonically, though, it would be okay?
Sonically, it would likely not be a problem. There are people who really think that exotic cables are the cat's meow and really what you need. I'm not one of them. I if you have good enough gauge, if you have enough copper there, if it's not small, mm-hmm. If it's not tiny, thin little wire, if it's thick wire, I don't think you need exotic cable, and it'll sound perfectly fine.
A question about television placement. Is there a good reason to ever place a television above a fireplace?
No.
No.
Absolutely
not. Angle's all wrong.
The angle's all wrong. People often think that the answer is no because it'll get heated by the fireplace. That's not true. If it gets heat from being on the wall of the flue, then the flue is designed badly. You're not supposed to get hot there. Now, some fireplaces have a radiator in front of the fireplace, which is meant to push the heat into the room. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a radiator, a fireplace is going to actually suck heat out of the room. It's going to suck air out and shoot it up the chimney. So people put a glass or a metal radiator, which takes the heat from the fire and then radiates it back out into the room. If you do that, some of the heat is going to actually go up in front of the fireplace and heat up the TV. Now, how much it's going to really heat up is probably not that much. The primary reason not to do it is that the angle is wrong. You're craning your neck to watch TV, and by the end of a two-hour movie, I guarantee you're going to need a chiropractor.
So I would think the only good reason is if you have seats that are matched to the same height.
Well, maybe. Yeah, but those would be like bar stools. One thing you could do, there is a type of mount that you put the TV over the fireplace, mm-hmm. and then when you want to watch TV, the TV actually comes down.
Like a giant Visa arm kind of thing?
Like a giant Visa arm, exactly.
Oh, wow, okay. I didn't know they had that capability.
They do. They're not cheap, but you can use them. And then when you bring it down to a reasonable height, okay, then, and when it's not in use, you put it up there, okay. But I go on walks in my neighborhood, and I look in people's windows, and I see these TVs over the fireplace. I go, don't do it!
You don't want to go to my place then. Final question.
Yes.
Movie theater popcorn, full-on butter or light butter?
Well, since I don't eat popcorn, I can't really say. But if I did, I'd go full butter.
Oh, thank you, Scott Wilkinson, for this. This is exactly what we needed to know. Now we know my system is all screwed up, but we can replace it with coat hangers. I do like that.
And you'll be all right.
Well, yeah, all right. Thank you so much. Now, Scott Wilkinson was in town, thankfully, because he was setting up Leo's television. If you want to check out his episode of Home Theater Geeks where he's setting up Leo's curved, awesome OLED TV, check out Home Theater Geeks episode 175, I believe it is. Yes, Home Theater Geeks 175, where he and Robert Herron go into Leo's house and decide to calibrate that television to sheer perfection, because that's what they do. They're professionals right there. I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Know How, Padre.
Yeah, that was a lot of material.
Came to an end.
How about that?
But then again, it's a lot of material, but that's why we have the best show notes in the world for Know How on the website on twit.tv/KH.
Right, right.
We're going to really qualify that one. It's the best show notes for Know How. twit.tv/KH. If you want to watch past episodes, if you want to download this stuff in glorious HD, if you want to see last week when I was trying to make a portable podcasting rig, that's what that image is. All the notes for everything we do. So in case you're like, hey, what on earth? What were those commands Padre was showing today? And if you're like, hey, what parts did they use for this particular build? Or what about that thing from the hack shop? Where do I find this stuff? Everything at twit.tv/cage.
Yeah, that's all in there. Yeah, and you know what? If you have questions about those show notes or about future topics, or if you want to suggest a future topic, then why not contact us directly via email at knowhow@twit.tv. I promise we'll respond to you at some point, probably, hopefully, maybe Shannon.
The email's always good, but there's always our Google Plus community, which is really, really fantastic. I almost said forum because it feels like a forum.
It does, right?
It's fantastic because it's all in public. So instead of having, hey, did you see my email? Did you see my email? Did you see my email? You could just put it up on the forum, or I mean on a community, and we can actually write back to you, put a plus one. Sometimes you put up other videos. There's actually an Inside Know-How video of me fixing my Galaxy S3 using some new parts. You can see Padre's involved in the community. He talks back. There's lots of interaction going on at our community. So if you want to have a conversation, Google Plus community, gplus.to/twitkh is the easiest way to find it. Or go to Google Plus and do a search for Twit Know How.
But you know what? If that stuff kind of, well, threatens you, if you don't like the idea of the Google community, you could also reach out to us on Twitter. All you have to do is write your comment, whatever it might be. Maybe you have a question about something that I did with Wireshark, or you have a question for Ayaz about something with the bass speaker, the subwoofer crawl. It's a new thing.
Yeah.
But you can just write it with the hashtag TwitKH.
What is that, a gang sign?
That's the thing.
Represent. Right? Representing... Yeah, but it also lets you keep it nice and sweet and short, thanks to Twitter. I love Twitter for that. But yeah, we always have that search on. Yeah. Taking a look at that. Next week, I don't know. Oh, next week we're going to show you how never to lose your stuff.
Stuff. Yeah, because if you lose it, you got to watch before you know. That's not the name of the show.
Now that you know how to tap your network with Wireshark and how to mess with your home theater even further, go out and do it.